Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we will be featuring Paul Wiemer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the upper Delaware River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Paul Wiemer about fly fishing the upper Delaware River. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For information, go to the Federation site at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Paul, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For tonight's drawing, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Paul's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Thanks to Paul Wiemer and Stackpole Books, we will also be giving away copies of Paul's books, Fly Fishing Guide to the Upper Delaware River, and his latest book, Pocket Guide to Pennsylvania Hatches. So given the subject matter of tonight's show, these will be invaluable to you folks. So pay attention. And to win these, here's what you do. Pay attention to what we say during the show. And at the end of the show, I'm going to ask a question about something we talked about during the show. And the first person to submit the correct answer wins this nice set of books. Now, you're going to submit that question in the text box on our homepage, the same text box that you can submit questions during the show. That's where you can submit the answer to this question at the end of the show. So pay attention and be nimble with your fingers at the end of the show so that you can have a chance at that. Our guest tonight is Paul Wiemer. Paul was born in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and taught by his father to tie flies and fish in central Pennsylvania's fertile limestone valleys. Paul's entry into the fly fishing business was in 1998 when he began managing a fly fishing lodge and shop along the upper Delaware River. He eventually left that position to become the managing partner of Border Water Outfitters in Hancock, New York. And then in early 2007, after spending a decade in the Delaware River watershed, Paul returned to central Pennsylvania as the manager of the TCO Fly Shop and State College. Paul is a former trout and steelhead guide and a production fly tier. His flies have been featured in the Pennsylvania Outdoors television series, Catskill Fly Fishing Museum, and Charles Meck's landmark book, The Hatches Made Simple. Paul is a contracted fly designer for Montana Fly Company and the inventor of Wiemer's Streamer and True Form Fly Series. Paul is a pro staff member of Regal Engineering, Hobie Optics, and Daiichi Hooks, where he designed the Daiichi number 1230, Wiemer's True Form Mayfly Hook. Paul is a regular contributor to Fly Fisherman Magazine and a former fly fishing columnist for the Hancock Herald newspaper. He has been featured in numerous books and magazines in the New York and the New York Times. Paul's first book, Fly Fishing Guide to the Upper Delaware River, is proving to be a must-have for anyone fishing the Delaware. This year, Paul's two newest books have been released. The first, co-authored with Charles Meck, is The Pocket Guide to Pennsylvania Hatches. And the second book, Tying Dry Flies, is also a collaboration with Jay Nichols, Charlie Craven, and Mike Heck. Paul, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, good to have you. Good to have you. At least we're knocking on the door of spring out here in Colorado. How about you?
The same here, although we got quite a bit of rain today. Penn's Creek looks like the Mississippi River right now.
Oh, does it? Okay.
It does.
Well, we're not quite there yet. So, but there's still fishing to be done, and so we're going to talk about the Delaware River system, Upper Delaware River system tonight, and hopefully we can enlighten the folks about the river system up there and give them another place to wet their line. So let's just jump right in here, Paul. Let's why don't you first tell us where the Upper River Delaware system is, because we do have international listeners, and a lot of people may not know where it is.
Sure. Well, the Upper Delaware forms the border between Pennsylvania and New York. If you look across Pennsylvania's northern border, it's a straight line, but where it starts to get all squiggly and curved down at its eastern side, that's the Delaware River. It begins with two reservoirs that supply New York City with drinking water, which are about 2.5 hours from downtown Manhattan.
Wow, that's pretty close.
It's very close.
Now, a lot of the pictures in the books, you'd never know it was that close to a major city, but it doesn't take too far, you know, you don't have to go too far out of New York City to get into some really, really fine country. Now, what rivers and branches make up the river system? Because this really is a river system and not just one single river, right?
It really is. You're talking three really distinct rivers. There's a big reservoir called the Pacton Reservoir, which is on the east branch of the Delaware. And the upper east branch flows out of that reservoir, and it travels about 17 miles to the town of East Branch, New York, where it's joined by the Beaverkill. The upper east branch and the Beaverkill combine to form what we call the lower east branch, and that runs about another 17.5 miles to Hancock, New York. On the other side is Cannonsville. That's a reservoir at the top of the west branch of the Delaware River. And the west branch travels approximately 17.5 miles to Hancock, New York as well, and it joins with the lower east branch to form the main stem. So you're really talking three distinct rivers as part of the Upper Delaware system.
Now, how many miles in the area you just talked about, how many miles are there of quality fishing water in that?
It really is amazing, Roger. When you add it all together, if you do not count the Beaverkill and the Willowemoc, which are technically part of the Delaware system, just the three branches of the Delaware alone, it's almost 80 miles of trout river.
And this is quality river, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, of course, the Beaverkill itself is a whole other fishery that is legendary, right?
It absolutely is. You know, a lot of the beginnings of American fly fishing, a lot of the innovations and fly patterns took place right there along the Upper Delaware River and in the Beaverkill. And the Willowemoc, too. George LaBranche, you know, famously made what a lot of people consider perhaps the first cast of a dry fly on right where Mongop Creek and the Willowemoc come together. And from, you know, Theodore Gordon to Rube Cross and the Darbys and the Deddies, just there's a lot of our angling heritage that began along the Beaverkill.
Wow, wow. What fish live in the Upper Delaware system? I've read about all kinds of things, and I know the river from where we're talking about, which is the upper section, goes all the way down to the Atlantic. But what are the primary fish that we'd be targeting up in this area?
You're really talking about trout, although there are other fish that are certainly there. But you're really talking about rainbows and brown trout. A lot of people associate the Delaware specifically with rainbows. And there are some small populations of brook trout. The Upper East Branch has a reasonable population of brook trout. And a lot of the feeder creeks to the Delaware contain pretty healthy populations of brookies.
We had some questions. Hank in Randolph, New Jersey, and Cliff in Bethel, New York, both asked about shad. Now, are the shad up this far in the river, or is that lower part of the river?
Sure. They certainly can be, Roger. It depends on water flows. Shad, some salmon return to the rivers where they were spawned, and there's even some some radio telemetry studies that have been done on Delaware trout that prove that they go back pretty close to where they were spawned to spawn again. But shad aren't as discerning. If the water is low, they'll just stop and spawn as far up as they can get. Now, in a high water year, you know, we get two runs of shad. We get the large American shad, and we get smaller hickory shad. And I've seen hickory shad as far as the Willowemoc, which means they ran up the longest undammed river east of the Mississippi, the Delaware main stem, and split up into the Low Reefs branch at Hancock, split off into the Beaverkill from there, and then up into the Willowemoc. It's pretty amazing. In the American shad, you'll see those as far as the reservoirs, pretty much as far as they can go in the Delaware system. But in a low water year, and we've had a few of those in recent memory, the shad won't make it very far. They'll stop and spawn south of us, and you won't see many up in the Delaware.
So Hank's question about what part and also, time of year and so forth, it just depends is what you're saying. One year you could have great shad fishing up there, and the next year none, right?
That's absolutely true. And if I wanted to specifically target shad, I would go to lower portions of the river, down the Delaware Water Gap and in areas south of that. The trout fishery itself only extends, the classified trout fishery, down the first 27 miles of the main stem of the Delaware. That's okay. Down to about Calicoon, New York. But again, the Delaware is a long, long river. And if I wanted to be reasonably sure I'd hit the shad, I would fish lower down.
Okay. Now, are the rainbows and browns considered wild fish here? Are they stocked? Is it a mixture?
Sure. Well, the rainbows are entirely wild. There's been a great deal of debate as to where the Delaware rainbows came from. And there's a story you hear quite a bit up in the Delaware about a train that was traveling near Calicoon, New York, carrying McLeod River strain rainbows to stock into the West Branch of the Delaware. And the train broke down, and a man by the name of Dan Cahill took buckets and put those fish in Calicoon Creek. And for a long time, people believed that that was the brood stock of all the rainbows in the Delaware system. But I spent, you hear a story a lot, and you kind of really want to know if it's true. And a good friend of mine, Ed Van Putt, is probably the foremost Catskill historian. Ed's a great writer, but he doesn't like to write. What Ed likes to do is research things, and he spent days upon days in every little library in the Catskills trying to find information on this train wreck that occurred. And he hasn't been able to find anything. And Ed believes that that's pretty much just a legend. If you read The Notes and Letters of Theodore Gordon, which is a really cool book full of Catskill history, Mr. Gordon talked about rainbows being stocked into the Beaverkill, as early as the late 1800s. So what probably has occurred is there's just an amalgamation of rainbows that were stocked into the Delaware over time that have grown accustomed to the river and over the last 100 years evolved into their own species there. Cornell University did a study, and that study said that Delaware rainbows are genetically distinct, different from rainbows found anywhere else in the world.
Wow.
So all the rainbows are wild. You're actually, it's neither New York nor Pennsylvania is allowed to stock any rainbows, even into the feeder creeks. Now the brown trout, it kind of depends on where you're talking about. There's no stocking whatsoever that's done into the West Branch or the main stem. But they stock some of the feeder creeks. The East Branch receives, I think it's 6,000 or 7,000 brown trout each year, which it's kind of a shame that the river certainly doesn't need to be stocked, but the state still does it. So most of the time, most of the fish you're going to catch anywhere you're fishing in the Delaware is going to be either a wild rainbow or a wild brown.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Now, do we get some big fish up there in the Delaware?
Yeah, and that's really the major draw of the system. In fact, sometimes it's hard to find any small fish. Average fish on the Delaware is probably 15.
Sure, Paul.
Look, I don't even...
They're starting their cars and packing right now. Sure.
I don't even own a fly shop anymore there, so this is certainly unbiased information.
Okay.
But, well, there's going to be a caveat to this at the end. So.
Okay.
Average Delaware fish are probably 15 inches, whether it's a brown or a rainbow. But the rainbows only get to about 18, 19 inches. They have a shorter lifespan than the browns do. So after about 4 years, the rainbows are done. They die. the brown trout can get enormous. These Catskill reservoirs, you asked about stocking. Well, there's kind of an accidental stocking that occurs some years. These massive reservoirs have very large brown trout in them that feed on alawis, and oftentimes they can be swept over the breast of the dam. So in the book, I mentioned three truly significant fish that were caught over approximately the last 10 years. I mean, fish in the range of 15 pounds. But those are pretty rare. I certainly have never caught anything that big. The biggest Delaware brown I ever caught was a tape measured 24 inches on the nose. And honestly, when you're living there and you get to fish it all the time, 18, 19 inch fish, they're real common. You don't even whip the camera out for one of those, because if you catch a fish, it's going to be from that 15 to 18, 19 inch range.
Well, that's a nice fish. I mean, there's plenty of places where, you know, the average fish is 11 or 12 inches, you know, so I think everybody would be happy to have those as an average.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, the caveat, Roger, is that they're probably the most difficult fish to catch that I've ever seen anywhere.
Hmm.
Extremely.
Why is that?
Well, there's probably a couple of reasons. Number one, the river system is within something like 4 hours of one-third of the population of the United States. So it sees a lot of pressure. Number two, the water flows are always, they're erratic, and that's being kind. New York City kind of controls the valves, and there's a whole complicated process that determines how much water will be released down the rivers. But because of that, the fish don't have ideal growing conditions. And because of that, there aren't as many fish in the Delaware as, say, you know, the Madison River, or even Spring Creek here in Pennsylvania. So there just isn't a tremendously large population of trout in the Delaware.
Okay. Now, even when you say water flows, even up there in the tailwaters, I'm assuming we've got tailwaters off both the reservoirs up there, right?
That's correct.
Now, are those pretty consistent, or are those up and down as well?
They're up and down.
Okay.
The Delaware is unique in one particular amazing way. It's the only river system that I know of that the flows are based upon a Supreme Court decision. In 1954, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware sued the state of New York over their proposed Catskill reservoirs. They were worried that New York would just shut the river down to a dry riverbed. So the Supreme Court decreed that a set amount of water in cubic feet per second had to be maintained at a gauging station in Montague, New Jersey. Now, that number has moved around a little bit over the years. Currently, it's 1,750 cubic feet per second. So what happens is, if you get rain down below the trout zone, let's say 50 miles down the main stem, but it doesn't hit the rivers up top, they can reduce river flows because they don't have to maintain that Montague number.
Mm.
There are some habitat banks and things like that to protect the trout in the system, but that water usually isn't enough. Delaware fish survive in the Delaware more often than not just because they're amazingly resilient. The rainbows, you know, the broodstock of the rainbows we have today existed there before the reservoirs were ever built.
So the fishery wasn't created because of the reservoirs. It always existed, is what you're telling me.
Well, I will say this. It became a cold water fishery predominantly because of the reservoirs. Before the reservoirs were built, I have a good friend, Bob Laubach, who's been traveling to the Delaware since he was a little kid. I'm afraid to take a guess at Bob's age now because he may listen to this and yell at me later, but let's say Bob's in his 60s. So he's been going up there a long time. And when he was a kid, he would catch bass, a lot of pickerel, some walleyes, and every once in a while they'd see a trout. And Ed Van Putt's, when I was writing the book, Ed Van Putt gave me some newspaper clippings. And there was an article from, I'm going to say it was something like 1922, where a bunch of fishermen from New Jersey were talking about the great rainbow fishing that they had on the upper Delaware system. And that was long before the reservoirs were ever built. So there were trout there then. But when the reservoirs started releasing their cold water, it flourished into a predominantly cold water system.
Okay. Now, we did have a couple questions later on here, but I'm going to bring them forward in our agenda here, so to speak, because we're talking about the flow. Brian in New York. He says, please talk about your strategy for planning a trip to the Delaware. What do you reference? Gauges, temperature, flow rates? Is it better to catch the river on the rise or on the down?
Sure. It's an excellent question. When you become a regular Delaware fisherman, you study and look at constantly the United States Geological Survey gauges. If you go to you type in USGS into Google and you'll get the government's site, and then you just put in the state of New York and you can look up gauges in the Delaware system. There's also a release hotline number, and you can call that number and they'll tell you what the reservoir is releasing. The only problem is it tells you exactly what's happening at that moment. And at the end of the message, they always say that these flows will continue until further notice. Well, further notice could be 5 minutes after you hung up the phone. So it's difficult. I mentioned in the book, a good friend of mine, Ron Huber, we had a gentleman call the flash up one day. He was asking the same question that we just received. And he said, what are the flows going to be like next week? And Ron told him that, you know, I'd have a better chance of guessing the color of God's eyes than guessing what the Delaware River flows will be a week from now.
Oh,
and that pretty much sums it up. You know, if I had to pick one time of the year to be there, it would be the same time that's great everywhere in the East, from, you know, maybe the first or second week of May to the first or second week of June. You're reasonably assured of good fishing during that time. The rest of the year, it all depends on those water releases. If it's an exceptionally dry year and they need to run a lot of cold water to maintain the Montague target in New Jersey, the summer fishing can be spectacular. I mean, fantastic. And, you know, that cold water releases can invoke sulfur hatches that last 2.5 months. Every day, blizzard hatches every day. But if they don't run that cold water, then during the summer, the best fishing is a couple hours in the morning and then an hour right before dark.
Okay. Now, Mike Abramowitz in Rockville, Maryland, want to know more specifically, what are the optimal flow levels of the water when fishing from Hancock to Long Eddy? Now, that's the main stem, right?
It is.
And is there, or could you give us a couple of points of where, if a person was to call in, they'd have some idea if it was high or low? Or what's low, what's high up in that area?
Sure. Well, you know, you can always look at those gauges, and it will tell you what the average is for that year, but that's not going to tell you if it's ideal for you.
Right.
In my Delaware book, I have charts where I've included what I feel were the best wading and boating flows for each of the Delaware rivers. And basically, if the main stem is running 1,000 cubic feet per second or less, I consider that to be a pretty excellent flow for wading. Now, the only problem is that there isn't a gauge on the upper part of the main stem. So what you got to do is you got to take the West Branch Hale Eddy gauge and the East Branch Fish's Eddy gauge and add them together to try to get an idea of what the river's flowing at near Hancock. There are gauges further down, so it depends on where you want to fish, too.
Okay, okay. Now,
I don't know if I helped them, Roger.
No, yeah, well, it, you know, it gives them some idea.
Sure.
Because you're saying it is tough. It just is tough. And especially if you were planning to travel to get there, you know.
Sure.
It could be dicey.
But. Sure, and I would say anything from 2,500 CFS and under, you're going to be able to wade fish on the
okay.
main stem down in that area.
Okay. Well, let's take a little break here first, and then we'll jump into these different branches and kind of explore each one separately. So we'll be right back, and we'll talk more with Paul about fly fishing the upper Delaware River. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call them at 1-307-237-5997. That's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Weimer about fly fishing the upper Delaware River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Paul, before we jump into the different branches here, why don't you just give the folks an idea of what you're doing in the fly fishing world, privately or commercially, or you know, just what's going on in your world?
Sure. Well, I actually moved back to central Pennsylvania about 2.5 years ago. My wife and I had no plans of moving, but in a 24-month period, the Delaware River went through 2 100-year floods and a 500-year flood. Owning a fly shop is difficult enough when you can fish, but when those conditions, particularly the 500-year flood, that just wiped out a lot of the businesses up there for that year, we decided that we were going to move back to where I grew up, and right now I currently manage TCO's fly shop in State College, Pennsylvania. So within half hour of the Little Juniata River and Penns Creek, Big Fishing Creek, and Spring Creek. I still do some writing for Fly Fisherman magazine. I'm usually trying to do a couple of stories for them each year. Kind of taking a break from books right now. I promised my wife that I would take 6 months to a year and actually unpack some of the boxes here and perhaps even paint our living room and try to settle in before the next project comes along. But so I'm spending time refining tactics and experimenting with some new fly patterns and enjoying being in State College and enjoying working for TCO.
What's the website for TCO?
It's tcoflyfishing.com.
Good.
Stands for Teppelhocken Creek Outfitters, by the way.
Okay.
Which is why we call it TCO.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a little bit easier. Well, folks, you can probably see what Paul's up to by visiting there, and if you'd like to get in touch with him or if you're in the area, I'm sure he'd appreciate you dropping in and saying hello. So, well, terrific. Well, let's get back here to Delaware, and let's kind of break the river down. Where do you want to start, west, east?
Well, let's start with the West Branch. That's probably, when most people think of the Upper Delaware River, the West Branch is where they're headed. The West Branch has the most trout of any of the rivers in the system. It has the most stable flows. Cannonsville Reservoir, which is at the head of the West Branch, is considered a degraded water supply for New York City. So they can and they do drink it, but the water's not as clean as the water in the Papacton Reservoir on the East Branch. So they use the Cannonsville Reservoir to help maintain that Montague flow I was talking about earlier. So generally speaking, if you're going to get cold water releases in significant amounts, it's generally going to come down the West Branch. Because of that, the West Branch maintains the highest number of trout. West Branch is, it's a beautiful river. It's amazing. It's very easy to wade. All the rivers up there are easy to wade. They have pretty uniform stream bottom with small rocks and gravel. When you get way down on the main stem, it gets a little more difficult to get around. The West Branch, it's characterized by, you know, long, flat pools and riffles of medium depth that hold a lot of fish, as do the pools. It's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of trout water.
How long is that stretch?
It's funny. When I was doing the book, I wanted to get exact river miles on all these things. So I looked up a bunch of New York State DEC studies, and three studies had three different lengths for all the different rivers. So I've settled upon saying approximately 17 and a half miles.
Okay. Okay. Now, can you float the West Branch?
You certainly can. And at higher water flows, drift boats are pretty common.
Okay. And if you were, again, to... Since the flow is unpredictable, it's kind of hard to judge whether you should bring your boat or not, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's times, Roger, you know, if the reservoirs are spilling, you're going to have a pretty good idea that there's going to be some water in it for a little while. And there are other websites, and I give them all in the back of the book, where you can actually go in and look up the reservoir storage capacities. So if you see that they're spilling, you know they're going to be dumping water into the river, and that it happens usually in the spring. Other than that, you can kind of get a feel for how much water they need downriver, but you're right, and it is possible to be out there floating and for them to be curtailing the flows, and all of a sudden the water's draining out beneath your boat. So
I could just see it now, that my drift boat up on a gravel bar and stranded.
Well, the other side of that, which is good, is that, you know, some tailwater rivers, the siren goes off and you better get your butt out of the water,
yeah.
You're going to get drowned. So
yeah.
That doesn't happen on the Delaware.
That doesn't. Okay. Now, in that section, and I'll ask you these same questions about the other sections, but is this a fly and lures only area? Is there catch and release areas? What's the laws like there?
Sure. There is one, the only no-kill section in the entire Upper Delaware system is on the West Branch near Deposit, New York. It's about 2 miles long. The rest of the river is classified as trophy trout water, and you're allowed to take, I believe, one fish over 14 inches.
Okay. So do you find a lot of people keeping fish there, or is there a lot of spin fishermen there that
fish? You'll see some spin guys in the first week of the season. You'll see guys up near the reservoir. They use salted alewife patterns. They call them sawbellies. And you'll see some of those guys and some of those truly huge fish, those 10-pound browns that get swept over the reservoir. A couple of those will fall prey to those guys usually every year. But generally speaking, outside the first couple weeks in the beginning of April, you see very few people keeping fish.
Okay. You had mentioned, and I did get a question here over the internet while you were talking about that branch, and maybe we can kind of answer this at this time. He says, because you had mentioned it's rather a large river with large pools and so forth.
Sure.
We've got Jim Smith in Connecticut. He says, any advice on how to break down the large size of the Upper Delaware rivers? I fish the system once or twice a year, and without rising fish, it's hard to know where to target for subsurface fishing. Can you give them any tips?
Sure. You know, Jim, I had the same problem. Growing up in central Pennsylvania, you know, the small little creeks we had around here were nothing. You could fit 5, 6, 10 of those of the creeks I grew up fishing in some parts of the Delaware. One of the things I found really helped me a lot are islands. The whole system's dotted with islands, the West Branch, East Branch, and Main Stem. When you go out and fish along an island, it cuts the river up into pieces. So you may be fishing a section that's half as big as it would be above or below the island. And you can kind of work your way there and figure out where the fish live, and that will help you to know where to look throughout the system.
How does that apply? We had another question here about the East Branch specifically. There's a specific technique used to prospect on the East Branch during non-hatch period. So do you have the same island effect there over on the East Branch?
You do, particularly on the lower East Branch. The upper East Branch, I would say, is the poorest of the rivers for any type of nymph fishing. There are some riffles up there where you can certainly catch trout with nymphs, but a lot of the riffles are rather shallow and don't hold many fish. In parts of the system, the Delaware, perhaps more than any place I've ever fished, is a dry fly haven. You'll see more guys standing around waiting for a hatch to occur than you will anywhere else. Now, that's not to say that nymphing isn't productive. The West Branch has some very good nymphing riffles. The Main Stem is tough. The riffles are enormous. So you'll catch fish there, particularly if you throw stonefly patterns. It's got a great population of stoneflies. But you have to be patient. And if there's one thing that I would say is one trait as a fisherman that's most important on the Delaware, it's patience. You're not going to go there and knock them dead and catch 20 or 30 fish. It just doesn't happen.
Okay.
If you fish and take your time, you have the opportunity to catch several exceptional fish.
And on a dry, right?
Absolutely.
Well, why don't you describe, since we started talking about the East Branch, why don't you more fully describe what we've got over there?
Sure. Well, the East Branch, as it comes out of the reservoir, its initial 17 miles, looks like a big spring creek, and it's the most intimate part of the system. Guys that are intimidated by some of the bigger water, like I was when I first got there, will feel very comfortable in the Upper East Branch. Because it's rather flat and glassy, and it has some significant weed growth in it at times, you have to be very careful, though. A lot of guys will go to the East Branch and get very frustrated and give up. It's a place that if you wade loudly into a pool, you can forget it. The fish will go down and you may not see them again, or you may not see them for an hour. So you have to be very, very stealthy. Once the Upper East Branch joins with the Beaverkill, it changes. It looks like a smaller version of the main stem with larger pools and braided water going into them and more significant riffles that hold fish. And the lower East Branch is a good place to nymph, and also a good place to fish draws.
Now, is that the area where Fish's Eddy is? Is that the area you're talking about? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. And then the Beaver Kill is the whole big system to the east of that, then.
Yes.
That merges there. It looks like, what is it, Peaksville? Peaksville?
Yeah. Peaksville, right, that's part of it, and right at the town of East Branch is where the upper East Branch and the Beaver Kill come together.
Okay, trying to read the map here.
Okay. Sure.
So then from there down, then we come into the, now, before I go into the main stem here, the West and East Branch, are there put-ins and takeouts throughout the system? What's the access like in those areas?
Sure. Wading access and boating access, I'm going to separate those two.
Okay.
There is a lot of wading access, a lot more access than people realize. One of the big knocks you hear on the Delaware is that it's difficult to access. But you take a look at the Upper East Branch, for instance. It's approximately 17 and a half miles long, and it has seven accesses where you don't even need to know the landowner. Seven public access areas. 17, I'm sorry. 17 for that river. So
one a mile, huh?
Yeah, and they're pretty reasonably spaced. Now, the main stem is a little tougher. The upper probably 5 miles of the main stem, there's only three access areas, but they're spread reasonably well. And then once you get below that, the accesses get further and further apart. The main stem is really the most difficult to fish without a boat, just because some of those pools are so big that they're difficult to wade under any flows. And the lower half of the East Branch, below where the Beaver Kill comes in, that probably has the least amount of access of anywhere in the system. It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around this place because you want to be able to make blanket statements and say that the Delaware's like this. But when you're talking about 80 miles of trout water, there's just differences. And the West Branch has a fair amount of access, too. I should also mention that the West Branch and the main stem are public navigable waterways. So once you access through public property, you can go wherever you want as long as you keep your feet damp.
Okay. Is it damp? Is it wet or the high water mark?
It's the high water mark.
Okay.
But there's a lot of talk about exactly what is the high water mark, so I tell people to keep your feet damp and you'll be fine.
Okay. Now, you said that about the West and the Main Branch, but that's not the case on the East Branch?
That is an excellent question. I talk about that in the book. The East Branch lies entirely in New York.
Okay.
So the West Branch and the Main Stem form the border between New York and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania and New York State are very, very different states with very different laws. Pennsylvania is a commonwealth, and for the most part, stream access laws have fallen on the side of the public here. In New York State, it's gone the other way. It's gone towards the landowner. The East Branch was also declared a public navigable waterway in 1822. And I think in the book I put in the actual law that was passed, a copy of it. But nobody really knows if a landowner can throw you out. I contacted the New York State DEC and said, so what's the deal? There was a couple of landowners that were tired of seeing boats, tired of seeing fishermen. So they were out telling people they had to leave. And the DEC said that we really don't know. This question will probably have to be settled in court. So it's kind of murky when it comes to the East Branch.
Okay. Well, we've got a question here from Jack Rovers in Ashland, Massachusetts. He says, I've tried to fish the upper Delaware but find access to the river difficult when I did not have a boat. And then he asked for suggestions on where to enter the river with success in wading. Also, same question regarding the Beaver Kill. So from what you just said, it sounds like where are the best places to go for wading?
Sure. The Beaver Kill's relatively simple. Old Route 17 parallels the Beaver Kill from where it dumps into the Upper East Branch at the town of East Branch the whole way to Roscoe. And there are well-marked public access areas everywhere along that river. You know, there's big blue signs. Half the pools are actually even named with a little bit of history. There's plaques there to them. So that's pretty easy with the Delaware, with the Beaver Kill. With the Delaware, a lot of the access areas aren't well marked. There may just be a little tiny sign that people can easily drive through. That's why with the book, one of the things I did was I included GPS coordinates to every public access area on all 80 miles of the river.
So bring your GPS.
if you got your GPS, now it's not going to be X marks the spot, here's the fish.
Yeah,
but
okay.
it's going to show you exactly where you're allowed to park and then you can go from there.
So you didn't mark on your maps the places where the 15-pound browns are residing?
I did, but they keep swimming and I got to erase the marks all the time.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay, so what would you say if you were to break it down to percentages, how many people float and how many people wade?
I would say, it's going to sound a bit misleading, but I would say probably 75% of the people wade.
Oh, really?
Okay. Absolutely. And once again, you'll see people in boats all the time. A lot of those people are guides. A lot of them aren't. A lot of them are people that just bought drift boats and like to float for the sake of floating. Funny thing, when I wasn't guiding, I almost never floated. Unless the river was just ripping high and I couldn't wade, I would never float. Hmm. One thing about the Delaware is you can be in one section of the river and the fishing's slow, and you can hop in your car and 20 minutes later you can be in a completely different river where the fishing's great. So I always hated being limited by that boat, because when I launch the boat, I know I got to go 8 to 12 miles before I'm going to take this thing out again. So I'm pretty much committed to where I'm going to be.
Right.
So
right.
The wade fisherman has a lot of options that the float guy doesn't.
Okay. Well, we need to take another break here, Paul, but when we come back, we'll be answering more of your questions about the Upper Delaware River system. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Weimer about fly fishing the Upper Delaware River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we've got a couple other questions here. And you've probably answered this again, but let's make sure we get these questions answered. Probably already answered these, but let's make sure we get them answered again. Ed DeGangi in St. Clair, Pennsylvania, and he gives you a little plug here too, Paul. He says, the Upper Delaware is everything Paul says, and his book's the best guide I've ever used on any stream. So,
well, a lot of people don't realize that actually my father goes by the name Ed DeGangi. So,
that's your father?
No, that's just a really bad joke, Roger.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Ed is a very nice man, though. He has a fly fishing club, and I've met Ed before.
Oh, okay. So he wanted to know the best chance at catching a trophy trout. When should he plan his trip?
Sure. Well, you know, Ed, of course, you got to throw me a tough question. I will say this. There probably isn't one exact answer. When the Hendrickson hatch begins in the spring, the fish are about as dumb as they're going to get for that year. So your chance at having a real good shot of fooling a big fish could be with a dry fly during Hendrickson's. Certainly, any time the river is up and off color, the Delaware is the finest streamer fishery that I've ever seen in the East Coast. The streamer fishing can be spectacular. And any time you throw on a big streamer, you got a chance of hooking into the biggest fish you've ever seen. The other time I would say is, you know, the green drake hatch, a lot of people like it, a lot of people don't. I'm a big believer in drakes. The biggest fish I've ever caught have been on the Upper Delaware system during drakes. The biggest Delaware fish have been during the drakes. And again, in the sulfur hatch, in the middle of the summer, if they're running cold water, there'll be sulfurs that hatch every day through July and August, and some of those big fish will move up near deposit and will be sipping sulfurs. It won't be easy to catch, but they'll be there.
Okay, okay. Another question from Greg in Atlanta. He says he annually ends up in New York City where he coaches a basketball camp every August, mid-August specifically. He says, I've always wanted to fish up there but always assumed the water temperature would be too high. Is this true or would it be fishable at that time of year?
Boy, it's just going to depend on what they're doing with those releases. There's going to be somewhere you can fish in July. How much of the
system? This is August.
Sure. In August. It's the same with August.
Same thing. Okay.
Yeah. You know, you can always go up and fish the upper parts of either the Upper East Branch or the West Branch. The West Branch, it would be in the Stilesville area. And the Upper East Branch, it would be up around Downsville. Those areas are always going to be cold because there's something coming out of the reservoir. How much more of the system is fishable at that time is going to depend on how much water they're releasing. And if you're lucky, and it's one of the years where they're releasing good water, then you can have phenomenal fishing, some of the best fishing of the year in July and August, to sulfurs and to blue-wing olives.
What other destinations? We've talked about the west, the east, Beaverkill, the main branch. Are there other fisheries in the area that, you know, if you were taking a extended trip there, that would be, you know, places you'd want to fish to?
Sure. Well, the Delaware is certainly the gem of the system, and I'd be hard-pressed to want to go anywhere else. But
okay,
if you wanted to get a little historical flavor, if let's call it an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and a half from Hancock, would get you to Bridgeville in the Neversink River, another legendary historic Catskill stream. If you're traveling, once again, from Hancock, it's about a half hour to Roscoe, New York, which is calls itself Trout Town, USA. There's actually a Catskill Fly Fishing Museum there. And that's where the Beaverkill and the Willowemoc come together, so you could certainly fish those. And there are just tons of little tributaries that are full of beautiful wild browns, brooks, and rainbows.
You had mentioned before, you know, you're near a lot of large metropolitan areas. Sounds like it could be crowded there during prime times. Can you get off by yourself there? Is that still possible?
It definitely is. I mean, I'm not going to say that you're going to find a section of the river where you won't see another human being, you know, during the sulfur hatch in mid-May. But you can certainly move to parts of the system where you're not going to feel crowded. I mean, when you're talking 80 miles of trout water, and most of the people, because the West Branch is so stable and so good, the vast majority of people flock to the West Branch. But the fishing on the East Branch and Main Stem can be fantastic, and you'll see fewer people in those two rivers.
Okay, okay. Nick in Salt Lake City asks, do you need a New York license to fish the East Branch, or is that still border water?
So, yeah, it's another good question. There's a reciprocal agreement between New York State and Pennsylvania that anywhere the river forms the border between those two states, you can use either state's license from either side. The border water consists of approximately the lower half of the West Branch and all of the Main Stem. So if you're fishing the upper part of the West Branch, or if you're fishing any of the East Branch or the Beaverkill, you must have a New York State license. And when people are traveling up there, I always encourage them, you're going to really limit yourself if you don't have a New York State fishing license.
So better to buy that one than the Pennsylvania, unfortunately.
By far.
Yeah. Yeah. For Pennsylvania's coffers, that's not too good, but yeah, be practical about it. Yeah,
sure.
Just a side question here from looks like Tom Hancock. He wants to know if your books are available or tapes of your books for the seeing impaired. Is anything like that available?
Right now there isn't, but boy, I would sure love to make something like that available. But currently there isn't anything like that out there.
Not available in an ebook form or anything like that.
It's not. You know, I don't know what Stackpole's plans are for the future, and that's something that, you know, I appreciate you asking me about. I haven't been asked that before, but it's something that I'd like to look into.
Yeah, I'm wondering about, I don't know how Amazon does this, but I'm wondering if they're doing this with all books or just some books, but, you know, moving them to the Kindle platform.
Sure.
And I would assume, I've seen the Kindles where you can enlarge the, you know, the text.
Sure.
To about any size you want. So I don't know if your books are available in the Kindle system or not, but that would be the easiest way to, I think, make it available to.
Yeah, and that's a great idea too, Roger,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we talked about licenses. Oh, if you're coming from out of town and, you know, say flying in, what's the best city to fly into? And
sure.
Where is the best place to stay in that area? If you're going to stay for a week or a few days or whatever.
Well, you got a couple options where you can fly into. There are two little airports. Both of them are 45 minutes to an hour from where you want to be. There's a little airport in Binghamton, New York, and there's a little airport in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And either of those places are where most people who are flying would fly into. The best place to stay is, without a doubt, Hancock, New York. It's right in the middle of it all. That's right where the East and West branches join to form the main stem, right outside of town. And within a half hour from Hancock, you can be in Roscoe, New York, to fish the beaver kill. Or within about 15 minutes, you can be up to Deposit, New York, to fish the very top of the West Branch near the reservoir. So Hancock is certainly the hub for the whole system.
Right in the middle of it all.
Yeah.
Good, good. Now, are there any camping areas available?
Boy, there used to be a lot more than what's there now. That 500-year flood that I mentioned that happened in 1996, it wiped a lot of the campgrounds off the face of the earth.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. It was unimaginable, Roger, actually. You know, 13 people died during that flood, and I watched homes go down the river. I lived on the end of the beaver kill. It was unlike something I've ever seen, and hopefully we'll never see again.
Yeah.
So there aren't a lot. There's Oxbow Campground on the Upper East Branch. There is Soaring Eagle Campground down on the main stem around Kellum's Bridge. In the back of my book, I list a whole lot of other campgrounds, but I'm not sure of the status on many of those right now. I'm not sure how many are going to be reopened and how many are not.
How badly did these floods affect the fishery?
You know,
or did they?
It's amazing. The Delaware, that river has never ceased to amaze me. What the fish can survive. You know, I fished after that flood when the waters receded. And it was just amazing. I would catch one of these beautiful fish and think, how in the world did, you know, when houses and cars are going down, how did you make it through? The river held up surprisingly well. And the hatches are great. Now, some parts of the river, particularly the West Branch, have changed a lot. Some of the pools have shifted a little bit. But the river itself is still in great shape.
We had a question from Mark in Dallas. It says, with close proximity to large metro areas, how clean are the waterways in the surroundings? And I think he's just thinking that this is maybe suburbia, but it's not really. Even though it's close, it's beautiful country in that area, isn't it?
It's spectacular. I mean, I've seen, you're almost guaranteed to see bald eagles. There's deer everywhere, wild turkeys and black bear. It's, part of it is on the border of the Catskill Preserve, which is just this humongous tract of public forest. You would have a hard time believing you're anywhere near those towns. The only trash really you see along the banks is there are some places that still have some debris from homes and trailers that were destroyed during the flood.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been efforts to clean up a lot of that. It's hard without somebody seeing it to believe that you're within 2.5 hours of New York City. But if somebody dropped you off there, you wouldn't believe it. It looks pristine.
Yeah, you know, some of the pictures in your book are just incredible. It's gorgeous, gorgeous country. Another question about the water itself. Camilla Santana in Westford, Massachusetts, asks if Didymo or whirling disease is a concern on the upper Delaware River.
That is a great question. And I'm glad we have the opportunity to get to this, too. Didymo is in the Delaware system. The entire river is now considered infected. I was there last spring and saw no evidence of Didymo at all. But when I returned in the fall, portions of the Upper East Branch and portions of the West Branch had a great deal of Didymo there. The reason I mention it, as of yet, it hasn't affected any of the hatches. It hasn't affected Didymo. Doesn't really do anything to the fish. It affects the hatches and then the spawning gravel. But it has had zero effect on the river. The only thing that I want to impress upon people is to buy a separate pair of waders if they're going to fish the Delaware. There's lots of great ideas out there about how you can treat your neoprenes with bleach or hot water. And I tried treating mine, and all the seam tape fell off my waders. And, you know, if you're going to go, and, you know, maybe I'm just going to fish the Delaware one time, I would say buy the cheapest pair of boots and waders you can find and just use them for that. It's the only way. I mean, Didymo's a terrible thing, and the worst part about it is that it's our fault as fishermen. We're the ones who are sprinting around all over the place.
Right.
So the only way we can be sure is to not use infected waders in a river that's not infected.
Speaking of waders and boots, so we got a question from Rick in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. He wants to know whether you use studs or not on your boots. Are those studs necessary in that area?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in studs. I definitely use them, especially when you get into the main stem. Part of it, especially as you approach Calicoon, New York, it can be rocky and difficult to get around. You know, it's pretty common for some of those rocks to have a little thin layer of scum on them that makes them very slippery. So I think studs are a real asset. You know, I'm not a believer that studs will, you know, the sound of the rock scare the fish too much. I haven't seen much evidence of that. I think we as fishermen can find other ways to scare them other than our studs.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about hatches and flies here, because I know you spent a lot of time studying the hatches of Pennsylvania, and of course we're dealing with Pennsylvania, and I'm sure this applies to New York as well. Bob in New Jersey says, "When is the optimal time to go to fish dry flies? Love your book. Looking into fishing the Upper Delaware a lot more this year." So let's use that as a lead-in to talk about the major hatches, because I'm sure there's dry fly fishing, from what you said, a number of different times during the year. So let's just break it down. Let's talk about the spring first and talk about the major hatches there, and, you know, give us some details, what kind of flies you favor for those hatches, and any particular presentation tips or things that you could give to the folks.
Sure. That was Bob that asked that question?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bob in New Jersey. Thanks, Bob in New Jersey, for the nice words about my book. The Delaware is an amazing bug factory, unlike anything I've ever seen. Nearly every species of aquatic mayfly, stoneflies, and caddisflies that exist in the eastern United States lives in the Upper Delaware River. There's only one or two mayfly species I can think of that aren't there. So the hatches are prolific and ever-changing. In the spring, the Delaware will get hatches of betas and spring blue quills. The blue quills can get some fish to the surface if the water is low enough and the temperatures are right. But it's when the Hendricksons begin that I really think the official dry fly season has begun. And the Hendrickson hatch in the Delaware River is nothing short of phenomenal. You know, it's very possible just to see the river covered with too many Hendricksons that make it even more difficult for your flies to be seen. And every major bug from then on out that you can think of that trickles on through, from all types of caddisflies to March browns and gray fox and slate drakes and sulfurs and green drakes, they all occur there. When it comes to pattern choice, the Delaware fish really respond well to flush floating flies. A lot of emerger patterns, flies with trailing shucks, flies that incorporate CDC or snowshoe rabbit, a lot of parachutes and comparidons. Of course, Al Cucci's a good friend of mine. Al Cucci owned a section of the West Branch that he's recently sold to Larry Clark in the last couple of years. Al Cucci designed his comparidon up there. So very flush floating flies. More fish are probably caught on the Upper Delaware system on a rusty spinner, perhaps more than anything else. During parts of the year, especially if it's bright and sunny and the water's low, some of the best fishing will occur right before dark. It's common to go out and see a pool that just looks sterile during the day, and all of a sudden with that last hour of daylight for 100 fish to be rising in front of you. And a lot of fish are caught on spinners. One thing I should mention is it's really common for a lot of people. A lot of us have grown up fishing dry flies upstream to rising fish. That doesn't work so well in the Delaware. If you're in a riffle, that can be productive to cast upstream to a rising fish. But a lot of these pools are very, very flat. And most good Delaware anglers fish quartering downstream to rising trout. That way, when you incorporate a reach cast into it, you put your fly, your leader, and tippet at a 45-degree angle between you and the fish, So that fly arrives at the fish without the fish ever seeing your leader or your fly line.
That's good advice anywhere you're at, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We did have a specific question about the Hendrickson, so let me throw that in there before you go on, Paul.
Sure.
Matt in North Carolina says, on the West Branch tailwater, during hatches like the Hendrickson, there are just too many mayflies on the water, and your fly doesn't get noticed. Yeah, we all been there, right?
For sure.
Any tips on improving your chance at hooking up with more fish in this situation?
Sure. A couple of things, and a couple of them are old standby tricks. Try throwing, you know, most of those Hendricksons you're going to see are size 14s. So try throwing a 12 or maybe even a 10. Sometimes when you got that many bugs on the water, something, you know, nature doesn't necessarily produce clones. So even amongst mayflies, there's some are a little shade of a different color and some are a little bigger and a little fatter. So if you throw one that perhaps looks a little more attractive. Another important thing, again, it goes back to patience on the Upper Delaware, is timing the rises of fish. Most of these fish will get in a routine where they're going to rise every so often. And what you need to do is make your fly go over that fish when he's ready to rise again. Now, that can be very difficult, especially if you have a bunch of fish rising in front of you. And one of the biggest problems that happens is that guys are standing around waiting for something to happen. And all of a sudden, fish start rising. Well, they get nervous and anxious and excited, and they start machine gunning their cast towards every fish within reach. You'll catch more fish if you just pick one and say, all right, that's the fish I'm going to catch. I'm going to study what he's doing. I'm going to look at, try to determine, is he eating a dun, a spinner, and a merger? And I'm going to try to time my cast to get it over him when he's feeding. And during these super hatches, like the Hendricksons or the Drakes, that you really got to focus in on one fish and decide, this may take me all night, but I'm going to catch him. And then once you do, you can try to move on and focus on another one.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're going to be casting all night anyway, you just focus it down and
sure.
And resolve to the fact that it's not going to be easy. And,
sure.
But give yourself more of a chance by focusing on one fish. That's good advice. We need to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk more about the hatches with Paul Weimer. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at powerfibers.com. That's powerfibers.com for more information. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Weimer about fly fishing the Upper Delaware River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Paul, so you mentioned a few hatches. Any other notable hatches in the springtime before we talk about summer?
Well, if, you know, I kind of lump the sulfur certainly in as a springtime hatch. There's, you know, the cornuta olives, the big size 14 olives that hatch during the mornings as you get towards the end of May and into June. They can be phenomenal. The green drakes are spectacular, just about as good, particularly on the Upper East Branches, I've seen anywhere else. But on the tail of the green drakes, the Delaware also has a phenomenal brown drake hatch.
It goes on and on.
Literally, it's the most prolific place I've ever seen. In fact, there's so much food on the bottom of that river, I'm almost surprised that the fish ever do rise. They could just stick their nose down in there and eat stonefly nymphs till they puke. And that's something else I didn't mention.
Okay.
Stonefly hatches, golden stones, and Pteranarcissus, the giant stonefly, you know, particularly the golden stoneflies, in numbers where you can put your hands in the grass and scoop out fistfuls. It's just spectacular.
Wow. Okay, what about summertime then?
Sure.
How does it change?
Well, in the summer, obviously, the rivers start to get a little lower. A lot of the fishing now is going to depend on exactly what they're doing with those water releases. Sulfurs can hatch for 2.5 months if they're running cold water, but it's going to be weird. A lot of people think sulfurs, you think, all right, towards the evening, up near the reservoirs where the water's coldest, where you'll see the best sulfur hatches. the good fishing may not start till noon or 1 o'clock, right in the bright, sunniest part of the day, because it's going to warm that water up. That water's coming out of the reservoirs, depending on the reservoir level, anywhere from the upper 40 degrees to the mid 50s. So when that water starts to warm up a tad, those sulfurs will start. Certainly, blue-winged olives on any rainy day, and the further you get from the reservoirs, when the sulfurs are occurring with cold water releases closer to the dams, when you start to get down below, you start seeing more blue-winged olives than sulfurs, and they can provide some fantastic fishing. Terrestrial fishing, a lot of guys don't think about that on the upper Delaware. And generally speaking, grasshoppers and crickets, that stuff doesn't work. I've never caught a fish up there on a grasshopper pattern when it wasn't near the golden stoneflies, and I thought the fish probably thought it was a stonefly. But ants and beetles work. In fact, you know, some of those long-lasting hatches, you know, when you're into your second month of a sulfur hatch, it's going to be pretty darn tough to show those fish a sulfur dry fly that they haven't seen 9,000 times before. So sometimes a little beetle pattern or an ant pattern will fool those fish, that even though they're eating those sulfurs.
I was going to ask you, you know, you talked about water temperature triggering hatches there. What is the you know, with the miles in between? You got 17 miles down to the confluence of the east and the west fork there, to the main stem. How much time does it take for that water to travel from each of those dams down to, say, that point? In other words, if you called in and you heard that they were just starting to do a release, how long would you expect it to have an effect down that far down?
Sure. It's going to be, usually you might have a day.
Okay.
Yeah. But it really depends on how much they do it. And sometimes you can get fooled, because sometimes they'll start releases real early in the morning or later in the evening. But let's call it close to a day, 12 hours anyways. And that's one of the great things with that cold water too, is that you can, because the hatches are going to be limited to when that water starts to warm up a little bit. So what do you do before noon? Well, when they're running that cold water, somewhere on that river is going to be excellent water temperatures. So maybe, and one of the true blessings of the Delaware is, maybe you start that morning down on Junction Pole on the main stem, you know, fishing to leftover spinners from the night before, or perhaps some olives that are hatching. Then you move up to deposit for noon for that great sulfur hatch. And then when that slows down in the late afternoon, as temperature starts to cool down again, you can shoot back down to the main stem for some great evening fishing.
Good strategy. Brian Rusco, and this is a question came in off the internet from Rochester, New York, says, please ask Paul if he's ever used cripples on either the west or the east branch.
Sure, absolutely. They work very, very well. You know, wild fish in general, you know, you see stockies, they do silly things. You know, you'll see these big fish that they'll be right in the middle of a heavy flow rising to eat little minuscule bugs. Wild fish, and Delaware fish in particular, they're not going to waste energy. They're going to look for easy meals. That's why I put a trailing shuck on everything I fish there. Even some hatches like the Quill Gordon, you know, the Epeira species, they actually emerge on the stream bottom and swim to the surface as fully formed duns. But sometimes I'll even throw a Quill Gordon, a shuck on a Quill Gordon pattern, just because those fish key into that. They see that shuck, and as much as a fish can think, they think, all right, when I rise to eat that bug, it's still going to be there. It's not going to have flown away. And it's the same with cripple patterns that work very, very well.
And by the way, we did a whole show with Kelly Gallup on spinners and cripples.
Sure.
So if folks want to tune into that show, they'll get all the details on those. I didn't realize it was such a big part of fishing, you know,
but
until you start really learning about it. A couple of questions here. One, Frank Wood in Norwalk, California, asked about multiple fly rigs on the upper Delaware, dry dropper, that kind of situation. And maybe at the same time you could, so he's asking, you know, are you using those kinds of double fly rigs? Is it legal up there? And then secondarily, we got a question on the internet from Dan in New Jersey asking size of leader for dry fly fishing, and do you use fluorocarbon or mono, anti, do you prefer a specific formula? So maybe you can kind of just talk about the different rigging options that you use or you can suggest to folks.
Sure. Well, when it comes to leader and tippet, what I tell everybody is that you want to be throwing the longest leader that you can effectively turn over. When I'm fishing dry flies in the Delaware, my typical standard setup is a 12-foot leader with about 3 feet of tippet tied into it. So I'm throwing about 15 feet. You're looking at big, glassy pools. Drag can be a real problem, so you want as much of a leader out there as you can. I'm not a big, I have friends who are, but I'm not a big stickler on tying my own leaders. You know, I buy the, what I generally do, and I fish a lot of 6X on the Delaware, is I buy a 12-foot 4X leader and tie 3 feet of 6X PowerFlex Plus tippet into it, which is fluorocarbon. And that's a pretty standard dry fly rig for me. Obviously, if you're fishing at night, you're going to want to cut that back to some heavier stuff. But that 6X is pretty standard. When it comes to the dropper rigs and everything, you don't see a lot of it there. Here in central Pennsylvania, it's very, very popular. But up on the Delaware, you don't see it a lot. You see a lot of guys, I should say with dry flies, you don't see it a lot. You see a lot of guys that, you know, the hatches are so complex and those fish are so educated that you'll see guys that love that challenge, that they want, you know, if the fish are eating the sulfurs that only have their left wing down in the water and one leg up in the air, they want to have a pattern that's going to imitate that exactly. But if
the real connoisseurs of dry fly fishing here.
Yeah. For sure. But I will say this, a non-weighted pheasant tail, greased up so it fits, floats in the film behind a dry fly, can be very, very effective on the upper Delaware. And you do see a lot of guys, the guys that are nymphing, like when I'm nymphing the Delaware, I never fish a single fly. I'm always fishing two nymphs. And you'll see a lot of guys up there throwing double streamer rigs too.
Double streamers,
two.
Wow.
Oh yeah, you see that a lot.
And what about, you know, dry fly with an emerging pattern coming out the back? That's basically what you were saying about the pheasant tail kind of.
Yeah, that and that can be really effective, but again, you don't see a lot of guys doing it, but it can work very well.
Okay. Let's get back to, did we finish with summer? Is there more to talk about on summer, or should we move to the fall?
Well, I should mention the Trico hatch during the summer. The Delaware has a tremendous Trico hatch, but it's not always something that you can rely on. A lot of times, those trichos will come out in funnel clouds, and no fish will rise. And sometimes the only fish that rise are the real little tiny guys. Now, oddly enough, I was up there a couple of times during tricho season this past year, and it was probably the finest tricho fishing I'd ever seen. Perhaps it was the water was unusually low. Maybe that was the reason. You know, again, these Delaware fish are kind of snooty when it comes to rise, and sometimes for minuscule things. Although I've seen them eat size 26 olives and with a lot of regularity. So the trichos can be kind of funky. And another thing is the flying ant hatch, which occurs usually in August. That can be some of the most spectacular fishing in the whole system.
Sounds like you got to bring all your fly tying gear and your vise out there.
Or at least,
because I don't think I have that many boxes.
Yeah, it's kind of pathetic, or at least a lot of money for all the fly shops that are up there.
Yeah, it sounds like flies would be a big business in that area.
There's no doubt.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on into fall and talk about the fall.
Sure. Fall is one of my favorite times of the year. Streamers, when the fish, you know, I'm certainly not advocating targeting any fish you ever see on a red, but before they start spawning, you know, those brown trout are thinking about winter and they're starting to feel a little aggressive. Streamer fishing can be absolutely spectacular in the fall. But when it comes to hatches, you know, you're going to have some tan caddis popping around. The slate drake hatch in the fall can be very, very good. Certainly some blue-winged olives. There's a little bug. It doesn't have a common name. It's a Leucrocuta hebe. It almost looks like a little blue-winged olive with light gray wings with dark gray venations and kind of a chartreuse-colored body. And the Delaware has a great hatch of what we call hebes up there. And that can certainly provide some spectacular fishing. One thing about the fall is, you know, the steelhead are running in the Great Lakes and hunting season has arrived, so you have a better chance of finding some excellent fishing all to yourself without anybody else around in the fall than probably any other time of year.
Okay. Now, what kind of streamers work well in the fall?
A lot of white
favorites.
Sure. Any time on the Delaware when I start with a streamer, I'm throwing something white. These reservoirs, as I mentioned earlier, are full of alawives. Well, alawives spawn in the top of the water column in the reservoirs, so they often get spilled into the reservoirs. And in some years, they draw the reservoirs down pretty low to maintain that Montague water level so alawives can get flushed into the system. I once saw windrows of alawives along the shore, enough that you could, once again, scoop up with your hands at Stockport on the main stem, and that's got to be 20 miles from the reservoir they came out of. So I always throw white patterns to begin with because trout remember those alawives, and the alawives kind of look silvery, and when they die, they turn a bleached, pasty white. So white's always great. Flies like, you know, Zuddlers, or great, great patterns. Certainly zonkers, you know, standard stuff, woolly buggers, double bunnies. They'll work very, very well.
I imagine a lot of Kelly Gallops patterns would probably work well on
that. I tell you what, Kelly Gallops got some deadly, deadly streamer patterns.
Yeah.
Circus peanut and stuff like that, just favorite flies of mine that actually work extremely well there.
Again, another show that folks should listen to if they want to, you know, listen to a show just on streamers. Kelly did a great show with us on that that would probably prove to be invaluable on the Delaware as well.
I'm sure.
Yeah. We have a couple of more specific questions here about some things. So let me just run through these things, and hopefully we can get these questions answered. We've got somebody using an avatar now called the Professor, and he wants to know, I've always wanted to fish the green drake hatch. Be there in mid-July. Is that a good time to catch the green drakes?
You're going to miss it. You want to think Memorial Day weekend, from there until the first or second week of June, you got a chance of seeing them somewhere in the system. But by the time July comes around, you're going to miss them.
Another question I know, considering all the hatches, this is kind of a broad-based question, but maybe you can just pull out a few out of your box here and tell Mike Abramowitz from Rockville, Maryland, he wants to know what your favorite flies in the spring are.
Sure. Does he mean dry fly patterns or?
I think so. It just says favorite flies. So, yeah, we're talking about, not about the insects, but the flies.
Sure.
A few off the top of your head that are your favorites.
Sure. Well, certainly my true form stuff, which are real flush floating patterns that were basically designed on the Delaware system, I certainly throw a lot of those. And, again, CDC comparaduns and sparkle duns and parachutes, anything that's going to lie flush. The Catskill patterns that became so famous in that region, I still fish them. I fish them during low light conditions. I use them at certain times of the year for blind casting and riffles. And I should mention this too. A lot of eastern anglers are used to just blind casting, fishing to likely looking spots in the water when they don't see anything rising. That doesn't work very well on the Delaware a lot of the time. A couple of hatches during the March browns, during the golden stone flies, and during the slate drakes, you can pound the water with those imitations and have a reasonable chance of pounding up a fish. But throughout most of the rest of the season, you're better off to sit back and wait to see an identified rise.
And I think the last couple of questions we had were on, Chris in Potterville, Michigan, and Dan in Illinois wanted to know about the go-to fly when nothing else seems to be happening, when you can't, when there's no match to hatch. We all have our favorite kind of go-to. Anything in your box that you want to tell us about?
Sure. Well, I should probably start with saying this too, that if you fish the Delaware River system enough, you're going to get skunked. There's going to be a day where you're not going to catch them.
Wow.
That's just part of that system. So there will be times when you could probably throw everything, including your fly box, at the fish, and you may not catch a thing. But I would have to say, again, when all else fails and I really don't know what else to do, oftentimes I put on a little rusty spinner. And that's probably my fly of last resort, and oftentimes that works.
You know, that fly came up in one of our other shows as a popular go-to. So you're not the only one that likes that one.
Sure.
For good reason, right? For good
Absolutely.
Reason. Yeah. Well, Paul, we're out of time, and we need to wrap things up here. But stick around with me here, because we're going to give away your books here in a little bit. And we're also going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So remember, we've got Paul Weimer's books, Fly Fishing Guide to Upper Delaware River and The Pocket Guide to Pennsylvania Hatches. So Stay tuned to see if you can win this. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, and that's at www.familyties.com, familyties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Now, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our show's database. And if you haven't registered by now, it's too late, but be sure to do so for our next show, because we're always giving away some nice subscriptions and memberships and books and all kinds of things. So you don't want to miss out on the chances of winning any of those prizes. So if you are the lucky winner, we will, since you had to give your email address when you registered, we'll contact you and get the information from you to get you your prizes. So the first drawing is going to be for the three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Always a great thing to have, and always a great thing to extend if you already have one. And if you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So let's see who our winner there is. We've got John Winslick in Missouri. John Winslick, well, congratulations, John. Again, a great thing to win on the show, and we'll be contacting you and get your three-year membership going. And our next drawing is going to be for Fly Fusion Magazine, a one-year subscription. If you haven't seen this magazine, it's a great magazine. You can learn more about it at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And this is out of Calgary, Canada, and now they're moving themselves extensively in the U.S. now. So let's see who that winner is. And that winner is going to be Camilo Santana. Camilo, you were asking questions on the show tonight, so congratulations. You now get a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Okay, and she's in Massachusetts. All right, now, a grand prize tonight, and this is going to take some work. You've got to go to our homepage in that text box and submit the answer to the question that I'm going to ask here about something that happened on the show. These books that we're giving away of Paul's, courtesy of Stackpole Books, Fly Fishing Guide to Upper Delaware River and Pocket Guide to Pennsylvania Hatches. Now, if you don't win, which most of you won't win, and you want to learn more about Paul's books, just go to our homepage, and on the left side you'll see New Books. If you go to that New Books and you go to that page, you'll find Paul's, both of Paul's books there, and it'll take you right to Amazon where you can order them, which I'm sure you're going to want to do if you're going to go fish that area. Okay, see if I make this a little more difficult than I normally do. When Paul was talking about his leader system, did he use mono or fluorocarbon for his tippet material? Mono or fluorocarbon for his tippet material? I usually don't get this detailed, but now, Paul, I'm just checking to see who sends this in the question. Now, remember, you got to put in the answer and your name and your location to win this. Boy, this has got a 50-50 chance here, don't you, Paul?
You certainly do.
Yeah, you know, it's not that hard. Okay, I do have, oh my goodness, I hope this guy isn't a ringer. Justin Samborin in State College, Pennsylvania. I think you could drop these off at his house now, if he has the right answer. Now, his answer is fluorocarbon.
Perfect.
Perfect.
Justin stops by the store, so he certainly should know that.
Yeah, well, Justin, that's a requirement. To get these books, you got to stop by the store and save Paul the shipping on these books. No, actually, they'll be coming from Stackpole Books. So, Justin, please send me your address and your contact information, and you can put it right in that text box if you'd like, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And then we'll get those books out to you. Now, here's a good thing, Justin. Once you get the books, then go over to the store, Paul's store, and get them autographed. There's your opportunity to connect with Paul. Right, Paul?
That would be great.
That'd be great. Well, Paul, thanks so much for being with us tonight and taking your time to talk about the Delaware River system. Sounds like a fantastic place to fish, and sounds like you got your work cut out for you, though, if you do go there.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. It was really fun being on here. And yeah, if you get a chance, the Delaware is certainly one place you don't want to miss.
Yeah, sounds like one to put on that on the bucket list, right?
That's
places to go
for sure.
In your lifetime to fish, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, our next broadcast will be on May 13th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Make note of that. That's not the first Monday of first Wednesday of May, as we usually have it. I'll be getting my punishment on a 120-mile bike ride in Moab, Utah. So if I recover, we'll have the show on this Wednesday, May 13th. On that show, we're going to interview Aaron Jasper, and our topic for that show will be European nymphing. I know this is a hot topic out there. Aaron Jasper has found through countless hours of testing and practice that European nymphing techniques require an investment in time to learn, but are very often unequal in their fish-catching potential. So find out Aaron's secrets as he explains a variety of Euro-nymphing techniques, including short leader and check methods, to long leader Spanish and French techniques. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.